So I started taking science courses at Mount Allison, and one of the electives that I took was a geoscience course with Dr. David Mossman, who has since retired. I really credit him for putting me on the path of geoscience and geology and the groundwater work that I do at the EAC. His passion for earth history and earth science was just absolutely infectious, and he really got me thinking about the Joggins Fossil Cliffs, and I did some internships there while I was doing my undergrad, and I ended up going and teaching English in Japan for a year, but halfway through the year I knew that that was my calling. I wanted to come back and keep going to school, so I continued at Dal and did a master's in earth science, and I'm so glad to be working on issues that are important in an area that I just love. I just love living in Nova Scotia. I want to protect it, and I want to help it be the best place to live, the cleanest place to live, and I want to use my geoscience. I always say this, I want to use it for good instead of evil. I want to stay out east, and I want to use it for improving the environment and not go out west and do other things.
You have a dream job.
Yeah, I really do. I feel like it's the best job I've ever had and I ever will have. It'll be really hard for me to ever leave the EAC.
What brought you to the EAC?
So I was doing environmental consulting in Halifax and in Dartmouth, and it wasn't a work-life balance that worked for me personally and for my family, and the groundwater coordinator position came up, and the purpose of that, the goal of that position was to develop Groundswell, and that's a program that's community-based groundwater monitoring. And so I'm still working on the Groundswell project. I have 8 wells across the province, and it's based on volunteers that go and upload the data, the water level data from these wells. So it's adding information about groundwater so that we have a better idea of the health of our groundwater and our drinking water. 40% of Nova Scotians rely directly on groundwater for their drinking water, and the rest of us rely on groundwater indirectly. So it's so important for us to have a good understanding of our groundwater.
With that study, you're testing for levels. You're not able to test for what's in the water?
That's right. So right now, we have loggers in each of the well, and each well, the loggers collect a water level measurement based on pressure every hour. And that's consistent with what the provincial government is doing with their groundwater observation well network. Mm-hmm. So we want to have the same data collection methods so that all of our wells can be used for monitoring over the long term. Mm-hmm. So for now, what we have the capacity for is hourly water level measurements, and that is really attainable for, it's really a sustainable project for a volunteer. When you get into water quality samples for wells, it actually requires a lot of technical expertise. You need to pump out all the water from the well to kind of flush it and get a representative water sample. You have to take a sample in a very particular way, and you have to decide where the sample is coming from, either the surface water or the base of the well. Mm-hmm. So I think that with some additional funding for that project, I'd like to hire a consultant to do all of my wells professionally, and that's definitely not something that volunteers can do very easily or very very thoroughly. Mm-hmm. So it needs to be done by a professional. So for now, the water quality isn't part of Groundswell, but down the road, I definitely want to have a baseline sense of the water quality in all these wells. And part of Groundswell is there are some communities that have no ongoing groundwater monitoring. There's no provincial well, and there's no groundswell wells on the Knoll Shore, for example. And if we had a groundwater observation well running during the time that fracking occurred, we would have just a rich amount of data that would show how a surface water aquifer is impacted by activities that the vertical fracking that they did in that area. Mm-hmm. So one of my goals in the next year is to really focus on that area and to find a groundwater observation well that could be a well that could be used for monitoring over the long term.
Yeah, I understand that hydraulic fracturing uses a tremendous amount of water to manage to crack the rocks and underneath. Mm-hmm. Speaking of hydraulic fracturing, I was wondering, as a geoscientist, are you able to explain the difference between what's popularly known as fracking, and the drilling methods that are currently being used in Pictou County for coal bed methane extraction.
I can speak really generally to that, but I'm new to the field of coal bed methane, but I do understand some very general concepts. When you look at fracking, you need to drill. The target formation for shale gas is a bed of shale, and it's generally quite deep. So it could be a kilometer to 3 kilometers beneath the surface, whereas the target for coal bed methane is closer to the surface. That's the first difference. The amount of water is different. With fracking, when you're looking for shale gas or shale oil, you need to inject water into that formation. Whereas with coal bed methane, you actually need to pump out the water from the formation. So in one case, you're injecting water in high pressures into the formation so that it will release or liberate the molecules of oil and gas from that formation, allowing it to come up to the surface to be collected. And in coal bed methane, you're using water, you're pumping out the existing water and fluid that naturally contains the oil and gas.
Okay.
So those are the two basic differences. The similarities is that you're still going to be left with wastewater. In fracking, you pump the water in, you pump it out, and then you have wastewater that has the introduced contaminants and also the natural contaminants. With coal bed methane, you pump out the water that has the natural contaminants, and you need to find a place to put that. So it's a lot of water that needs to be treated in a very unique way. It's not water that can just go through a municipal sewage treatment facility. It's not laced with bacteria, so to speak. It's more laced with natural contaminants like metals, sulfur, salts, in a lot of cases radioactivity. So those are the major differences between the two techniques. In some cases, the coal does need to be stimulated or fractured in order to release more of the oil and gas. So then you have the similar process. You need to inject it with water and chemicals, and then you have even more wastewater. But the other big difference with coal bed methane is that it's close to the surface. It's within the same depth as our existing drinking water aquifers. So there is there's more chance of, there's a clear altering of the water system, the groundwater system,
mm-hmm.
with coal bed methane, because you need to pump out water from the surface aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to alter the water table in that area. So some wells might find that their wells go dry, or that it takes longer for the wells to recharge, for example.
Okay.
But there are more direct, immediate, short-term impacts on local groundwater aquifers with coal bed methane than with fracking.
Okay. I understand that drilling isn't the only method. Is there strip mining techniques employed in Nova Scotia?
I can't speak to that. To the best of my knowledge, extracting the methane from coal beds does make the coal more viable, because you're essentially removing a type of risk with the coal mining. So you can remove the methane, and then it's actually safer to go down and mine that coal, because you've removed a risk of explosion, a risk of health impacts. So to the best of my knowledge, the mining is mostly just for the coal. It's not for the methane.
Okay. I understand that the current moratorium on hydraulic fracturing in Nova Scotia applies only to onshore deposits, and that it doesn't include a moratorium on seismic testing. To your knowledge, am I correct about that?
As far as I know, the moratorium is just for hydraulic fracturing, and it does not include seismic testing, because that to have a moratorium on seismic testing would also impact the mining industry. And likely there are other survey and research activities that go on using seismics.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of them right now. But storage, underground storage of CO2 or, it would be very, very difficult to have a ban on seismics.
Okay, I'm asking these questions because I've noted that there are concerns in New Brunswick about the shot hole method of testing, where explosives are put into the ground,
mm-hmm.
and set off and readings taken from that,
mm-hmm.
and the explosive materials then are often still in the ground,
mm-hmm.
although they seal them with, apparently try to seal them with bentonite,
mm-hmm.
A clay material.
Yep.
But recent reports suggest that those methods of sealing are either not good enough or aren't being done properly,
mm.
and are contaminating water on a small scale.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement, that the charges that are required in seismic analysis, although they are small, an advanced seismic research project would require a lot of shot holes,
mm-hmm.
and the you know, there's a small hole drilled, you know, 5 or 10 feet or something, and then the shot is left in that hole, but the charge is not removed. Those holes are not remediated in any way,
mm-hmm.
so that charge is left in the ground. And if bentonite, if the clay, it's an expanding clay,
mm-hmm.
that they put into this hole, you're still going to have the explosive material, the remainder of the charge, at the bottom of that hole. And it might not come to the surface, but it will leach into the ground and into the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your take on the current public review and consultation being headed by Dr. David Wheeler at the Cape Breton University?
Well, at first we were really optimistic about this review. The previous model of review of fracking in Nova Scotia, it was very limited in its scope. It was also limited in its in the people who were reviewing it. It was an entirely internal departmental, mm-hmm. Review. So I'm really pleased in two things: that they've broadened the scope to include health and socioeconomic impacts. They've broadened the team, and they've taken it out of the intergovernmental sphere, and they've made it a more independent review. So I'm really pleased to see those two things, but I'm a little worried about some other aspects of the review. So, for example, I haven't seen that the skill sets that they're suggesting that the panelists have. I haven't been completely impressed with the skill sets that they've suggested,
mm-hmm.
so I'm hoping that the panelists themselves, who are who apply or who are appointed by application, I'm hoping that they will show that they have a broad understanding of fracking, a really thorough understanding of the environmental and health impacts, and that they really see the long-term planning and the long-term impacts of the decisions that will be made by this panel,
mm-hmm.
So that they will incorporate the absolute best use of this panel for the long-term health of Nova Scotians. So I'm hoping that the panel will continue to move in the right direction.
What's happening with the so-called brine water up in Kennetcook Ponds? I had read articles where you were quoted in the articles about those brine waters, but these were some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Are those waters still up there?
There's one pond that's remaining. So in Kennetcook, they drilled 5 wells, and they used fracking in 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the EAC is a member of the Nova Scotia Fracking Resource and Action Coalition, NOFRAC.
Mm-hmm.
And NOFRAC actually spent 2 years working on a report that documented what happened in the Knoll Shore, in the fracking that happened there. So as part of our review, we found that there were 3 ponds initially during the activity in 2007-2008 when the drilling happened. One pond was drained immediately, and we could not find documentation as to where the water was taken. So that's a concern.
Mm-hmm.
The company and the government also can't quite pinpoint what happened to that water. So I won't speculate as to where I think it went, but it's very concerning that no one remembers or documented where it mm-hmm. went. The next pond, it appeared to be leaking a few months or a year afterwards, so they drained that pond. And most of that water went to Atlantic Industrial Systems in DeBert. And there's one pond that's remaining. And that pond, they've been draining it, not draining it, they've been skimming off the water regularly as rainfall increases the level of the pond. They need to keep it from mm-hmm. overflowing. So that's kind of the history of the ponds.
What happened with the water that went to AIS or the water that they skim?
So the water that they skim continues to go to AIS. Some of it was through kind of a deal with the municipality of Windsor or the town of Windsor. Some of the water that came off the pond actually went into the Windsor sewage treatment facility.
Mm-hmm.
And then out into the Bay of Fundy. And we were very disappointed to learn about that because those treatment facilities don't treat the radioactivity and the salinity and a lot of the things that are in that water, and they don't treat the introduced chemicals. They probably didn't even know all of the introduced chemicals to that wastewater. So that material is now floating around in the Bay of Fundy and in the Atlantic Ocean. So that's an introduced risk to the health of our ecosystems there. As far as what's being done with the wastewater in DeBert, as far as I know, it's been put into ponds, open air ponds, and we do have a problem with the open air ponds in DeBert and in Kennecook because you're allowing certain materials to evaporate out of those ponds, and without a baseline air quality, ongoing air quality, in addition to baseline groundwater monitoring and ongoing groundwater monitoring, we don't have all of the information to assess the risks associated with these ponds.
Mm-hmm.
So the second pond was leaking. This pond, we have heard from the local community group, East Hants Fracking Opposition Group, that there are concerns with that pond as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of unanswered questions to do with the remaining pond. Unfortunately, there's not a really clear and honest solution for what should happen with the rest of that water. It would be irresponsible and unethical for us to, say, truck it to another waste facility in another province. That's just giving the problem to someone else, to another community.
Mm-hmm.
There are currently, to the best of my knowledge, no treatment processes that will adequately remove all of the contaminants in the wastewater, in fracking wastewater. I'm not aware of any in North America. So what complicates
that,
things...
That would seem to clear up a common misconception that I held for a while, thinking that they can just take the metals, take the chemicals out,
mm-hmm.
and then put them back in a plant and reuse them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful if we could find a system that would remove the guilty contaminants and be able to reuse them for something else and keep the water in a form that's drinkable. But that there doesn't seem to be a way to
mm-hmm.
do that. What complicates things is that there's no silver bullet solution to the wastewater, because everywhere that fracking happens, the geology is slightly different.
Mm.
So the chemicals that are used by the companies are slightly different, and the natural chemicals that are brought up are slightly different as well. So every fracking wastewater pond or fracking wastewater from every site is a little bit different from
yeah.
the next site. So you have to have a system that can deal with the up to 700 different chemicals that could be used to enhance fracking wastewater, fracking fluid.
Mm-hmm.
That is a monumental feat to find a treatment process that would deal with all of those chemicals in addition to all the possible natural contaminants.
How much of a concern are the naturally occurring radioactive materials?
They are a concern. Mostly they're a concern because we didn't have enough information about the naturally occurring radioactive materials or norms when they came up from the ground. So we don't know exactly how many norms there were in these ponds, in all three ponds. I believe there was one sample that was collected, but I would have liked to have seen more groundwater, air samples, soil samples collected from these sites to have a better sense of the health risk that was introduced from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
There's another kind of radioactive material. I think it's called enhanced norms or e-norms. And I don't have as much information about that, but they are of a more concern, and I'd like to look into that more, but I think there are the radioactivity is a complex issue with the wastewater.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any recommendations for Nova Scotia, the citizens of Nova Scotia,
mm-hmm.
About the kind of things they should address when they offer input to the fracking review?
Mm-hmm.
And
Or perhaps
information about where can citizens find out more information about fracking.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I really encourage people to go to nofrac.com. That's nofrac.com, and read the report that NOFRAC completed, because that's the most local information on fracking that exists right now. That talks about the fracking that happened in our province, in our communities, and it talks about the issues relating to the wastewater that's still there. There's a lot of information online, but I think that the Out of Control report is the most relevant and most important information that people can read to find out more about what happened in Nova Scotia.
Okay.
In terms of what people can do locally, if someone lives in an area that is a lease agreement block, I strongly encourage them to find out more about their drinking water, whether it's participating in a project like Groundswell to learn more about the ongoing health of their drinking water, or whether it's encouraging their municipality to take care of their drinking water, or to provide grants for drinking water analysis and groundwater analysis. It's really important for Nova Scotia to have the means to say no to this industry if we can show that it has a negative effect on our health and our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can show a before and after that shows proof without a shadow of a doubt that this industry has harmed our water, that would be a very strong way for us to prevent any further damage.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that it doesn't come to that, where we have to see the damage in order for us to stop it moving forward. But it's difficult to stop it without proof that something bad will happen. So I really encourage people to be active in protecting their groundwater and protecting their community values and their community characters. Their community character. So stay involved in municipal politics and help your municipal councils understand all of the impacts that fracking would have on their community and on their municipality.
Okay. My final question is, how is the Ecology Action Center working with other NGOs? What other groups are you working with?
Well, as I said, the EAC sits on the steering committee of the provincial coalition, NOFRAC, and we actually founded NOFRAC in 2010. But recently, the members who sit on the steering committee, the coalition formed in 2010, and the steering committee formed at the end of 2012. And members of the steering committee include the Council of Canadians, Sierra Club Atlantic, Environmental Health Association of Nova Scotia, and then the Ecology Action Center. There are community groups from the Knoll Shore, from the North Shore. There are community groups and citizens from Cape Breton and the Lake Ainslie area, from the South Shore, from the Acadian Shore, definitely from the Eastern Shore, really, our coalition represents the entire province, and that's something that we're very proud of, and it's a real strength that we can reach out to all parts of the province through this coalition.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds great.
Yeah?
Yeah, the coalition, having brought together so many resources, makes a good place for citizens who are busy living their lives, mm-hmm. and faced with this review coming up right at Christmas time.
That's right.
It's really good.
Yeah, so we encourage people to join the coalition as a way to know how to be most strategic and effective in participating in the review. So we're doing our best to find the strongest way for NOFRAC and for citizens to participate in this review. And I think that we're going to learn as we go along the best way to do it, but we hope that people will join us and learn with us the best way to participate in the review.